We are in the middle of a drama. Job chapter 14 at the end of the chapter. And what we're facing here is a situation in which a man is going through the agony of having to endure pain and loss and suffering and questioning in a circumstance where he does not know the whole story. And the one thing that all of us have in common with this great man is that we have to live in a situation where we walk by faith and not by sight, which means that we will forever in this world be in circumstances where we don't know the whole story. We don't know all of the forces at work. We don't know where our particular life story fits in the great scheme of God's purposes, which means that we'll always be here with things the Lord has told us that we have to take His word for. And in Job's case, the force at work is that there is an enemy who believes that no man can or will be able to take God at His word in circumstances he doesn't understand. That's very much where we are. Now, we've been through here's Job and here's his friends, and we've been through the first round of their struggle with this. And Job has pretty much said, as this conversation has gone along, what is hardest for me is that I don't understand why my life has to have all of this going on. I don't understand if things have to turn out like this, why can't I just go on? And then his friends have been shocked to hear that kind of thing, and so they have begun to comfort him. And in this first round of conversations, the three friends have what they've had to say. I would summarize it pretty much. Their comfort is that if Job will turn to God, God will still relieve his agony and give him better days. Now, I want you to see what I'm saying. He is asking, why is this happening? Why is God letting this go on? And they're saying, if you will turn to God, He will make things better, and you will see wonderful days in the future. Do you see the disconnect in that? What they're saying may be often true, but it doesn't answer what his struggle is right then. And furthermore, they seem to be offended at his question. And you'll notice in the first part of every one of these friends' answers as we go along, they become a little more self-defensive. Have you noticed that? They're getting tired of this pressure cooker in which Job is having to live, and the more they do, the more self-defensive they're getting instead of comforting him. And you'll see that as this second round happens. I want to say to you as we start that at the end of this first round of questioning, we've seen Job, while he still is dealing with despair, we've seen some glimmers of great faith in this man. And I'd like to call your attention to one or two of them as we get ready to start today. Look back with me at chapter 13 and verse 15. And there are other samples like this along toward this last end, this last part of the discussion. But his statement there was what?
Even if he kills me, I have hope.
All right. And I'm going to stay with him. In other words, even if I die. And Job feels like maybe God is trying to carry him, to slay him, but he still is going to hope in him. And then chapter 14 and verse 14 raises the it's almost like it's a question, but it still is a faint statement of hope. If a man dies, shall he live again? And he, remember we read last week, all the days of my service I would wait. You know, if I could know that. All right, now what happens at this point is the second round starts. And Job's friends, instead of comforting him with the idea that if he'll just turn to God, never mind the fact that he hasn't turned away from God, if he just turned to God, God will deal with his problem, but there'll be better days. Now then, the comfort hasn't worked, so the warnings start. There's the second round of conversations are much more, not if you'll turn to God, he'll give you better, brighter days, but if you don't turn to God, you're going to suffer the fate of the wicked. And Job is feeling like, how much worse could it get? So you kind of watch that. Now, chapter 14, verses 18 through 22 summarizes where Job is at this point in the case. And this paragraph is of special value because it has something in common with the other parts of the wisdom sections of the Old Testament where people struggle with the meaning of life. Psalm 90, the prayer of Moses, the man of God, is a little bit like this. The book of Ecclesiastes, which takes an under-the-sun look at the striving of man, is much like this. And what it says is, look around you. The world grinds on. The rocks wear away. The cycles of nature continue. And a man grows old and deals with pain, and he can't enjoy the accomplishments of his children, and he can't... He can't even celebrate with them when good things happen because of his own pain. Look at it. Brendan, would you mind to read this section, chapter 14, 17 through 22?
17 through
22. 18. Wait a minute. Chapter 14, 18 through 22. I'll get it right. I had a long day yesterday. Sorry.
But the fallen mountain crumbles away, and the rock moves from its place. The water wears away stones, its torrents wash away the dust of the earth. So you destroy man's hope. You forever overpower him, and he parts. Change his appearance and send him away. His sons achieve honor, he does not know it. For they become insignificant, he does not perceive it. But his body pains him, and he mourns only for himself.
All right, that's not an excessively positive view of the meaning of man's life, is it? Look at what it's saying here. The first two verses use nature to set the background for the discussion. The mountains crumbling away. You think of erosion or that type of thing. Rocks removed from their places. The rolling down the hills and so forth. The waters wearing away stones and so on. And Job is saying, just like that happens, the hope of man is gradually worn down and destroyed by whom? Like an inexorable process that's always ongoing, and if there's nothing a man can do to prevent, who does Job see? Pardon? All right, we think the devil, but he's thinking God is the... Now, you and I know from chapter 1 of the story, the enemy is involved, but to a person living in the middle of it, it looks like this is how God rules his world. He gradually wears us down until there's no place to turn. We can't love him like a father, thank him like the great giver, We have to look to Him because we have no other choice. All right? And then, what does this mean for a man? And bear in mind, Job is not saying, I'm giving up my hope. Remember chapter 13, yet will I hope in Him. But he feels like this is what's happening. And in verse 20, he says, God always wins, essentially. You prevail forever against man, and man does what? He passes on. He finishes his course. He lives out his little space, and then you send him away. And verses 21 and 22 is sort of the most touching part of this. And you think about this. His sons come to honor, and the man doesn't know it. His sons are brought low, and he doesn't realize it because he only feels the pain of his own body, and he mourns for himself. Here's a picture of man living in his own little world, which is gradually imploding, and he's not able to think of anything else. Now, before you shake your head and toss that aside, think about this. If you are taking the under the sun view of the book of Ecclesiastes, isn't this pretty much how it looks? Think about it. One generation comes, another goes. The striving after wind that Ecclesiastes talks about goes on, and then that new generation, it lives itself out. And that's, unless God introduces something more into life, that's how it looks. Now, there is something about that realistic look at things that we can't live with, isn't there? What we've just read, is that encouraging to anybody present? Are you satisfied to think that your own life is a matter of birthdays, and then it's going to be over, and that's all it will have meant? I don't think any of us can be satisfied with that view of things. Job wasn't satisfied with it. That's why he's having this argument. That's the whole point. And his friends who hear him are really uncomfortable with it too, and so the conversation doesn't end. It continues. And let's think about this. First, any comment on what we've just said about the man's look for meaning in his life? That's one of the things that all of us have to spend some time doing. We talked about it some last week. Now, Eliphaz, the first one of his friends who has spoken already, whom we take to be the oldest and the one who must have been regarded as the wisest, begins to speak. And I want you to notice how many of these discussions now start with mention made about windy words. In chapter 15, verse 2, Eliphaz is responding to Job, what Job has said about their answers, about these friends' answers to him. This has been one of the parts of the story that they've all commented about as they've gone along. And what Job has said in chapter 13 and verse 4 is that these worthless physicians would be better off if they'd just keep silent. That'd be their wisdom. Well, that has offended Eliphaz, and so he starts with kind of turning that back on Job. And what he says in verses 1 through 6 is that Job's own words are the best evidence against him. And if you look at it, let me just point out to you some of what he says. Verse 3 says that Job's talk is unprofitable and it's words which do no good. Now, how do you decide whether talk is profitable and whether words have done any good? In your marriages, how do you decide that? In your conversations with your friends? Pardon?
It's changing.
All right. You may think if it changes something. Let me offer a proposition here. If words only make yourself understood to the other person, have the words profited any? Yes. In relationships, in any kind of relationship, the whole idea is that what's going on in your inside is understood by somebody who then cares about it. There is a certain part of human life which depends on the feeling that somebody understands me. Okay? And somebody understands what's going on. All right, now, with Eliphaz, this has become, with Job, a matter of a point argued to a satisfactory solution. Now, there are many Bible doctrines and so forth and things about our lives where that has to be done. That's important. But in the middle of suffering, the important thing is to be understood and to be cared about. Okay. And look at verse 4. The fear, Job, you're doing away with fear. I think he means the fear of God. You're hindering meditation before God by all of the rash things that you have said. Some of them are rash. Verse 5, your iniquity teaches your mouth. You're using the tongue of the crafty. And then verse 6, the key thought here in this section. What does he say, Becky?
Your own mouth condemns you, and not I, and your own lips testify against you.
All right, Job has said to his friends that they are worthless physicians who are speaking falsely of God in chapter 13 is the way he put it. And Job has sort of mocked their wisdom in the first part of chapter 12. No doubt wisdom will die with you guys. You know, it's what he has said. So in defense, Eliphaz says, we're not the ones who are finding fault with you. Remember, Job said, I'm being made a laughing stock by my friends. And Eliphaz is saying, we're not doing this to you. It's your own word. Your own guilty conscience is making you feel like this is happening to you. Basically, is what happens. Now, let me, as quickly as I can, walk us through the claims that Eliphaz makes here and try to see what's going on. First, in verses 7 and 8, he says, Job, are you the first man who was ever born? What would be the point in raising a question like that? All right. That Job is trying to make himself different from anybody else. Other people have gone through this before. You're not the first person to ever confront this kind of thing. And remember, since they are arguing based on what the men of the ages have supposedly handed down to them about how life works, they think Job is taking that on as if he knows more than any generation of people who've ever lived before. That's the idea. Verse 9 now, what do you know that we don't know? What do you understand that's not clear to us? I'd like you to observe that this is an answer to something Job has already said, chapter 13 and verse 2. You notice what Job said back there? What's Job claim? All right, Job has said, what you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you. And now Eliphaz says to him, well, can you almost picture two boys? My daddy can do this, my daddy can do this, and so forth. That's the, in agony, that when you're weary, that can happen. And what this man is saying, what do you know? We don't know. Both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, older than your father. So, and then look at verse 11. Are the comforts of God too small for you? Or the word that deals gently with you? Now, what does Eliphaz mean here by the comforts of God? All right. And what have they said about God to comfort him thus far? All right. He's probably disciplining you right now, and if you will comfort him, he'll take all this away, and you'll live life happily ever after. That's the comforts of God. Why has that not been enough for Job? Why has that been too small for Job?
He knows that he is not at fault in this situation.
All right. He knows that whatever weaknesses he may have had, they have not been such that demanded the loss of all the lives of all of his children, the loss of all of the all of the respect and so forth he's ever had in life, the loss of his the foundations upon which he's lived his life. It doesn't fit, in other words, his Job's experience. It hasn't applied to him. Now, verse 12, Eliphaz says, "Why does your heart carry you away, and why do your eyes flash that you turn your spirit against God with and bring such words out of your mouth?" They feel like, not that Job is struggling with his agony, but that Job has turned against God. And the reason is because he hasn't just accepted the statements they have made about why God lets these things happen in people's lives. Or more pertinently to their view of things, why God makes these things happen in people's lives. And remember that the whole thing at stake here is whether Job can be made to renounce his faith and his integrity. That's the whole issue in the background of this. Verse 14, if you think about ratcheting the pressure on Job a little bit at a time, if you think of the enemy working through Eliphaz to turn to bring the vice to bear a little more on him. Now he says, what is man that he can be pure? Or who is he is born of woman that he can be righteous? This is also a form of something Job has said before. Job has said to God, what is man that you make so much of him? That you have to do all these things to him and see what he'll do about it. And Job's already said that, and now this wise man is saying, Job, are you claiming that a man can be pure before God? And his argument runs like this. God puts no trust even in his holy ones, his angels, in other words. The heavens are not pure in his sight. He's so holy. How much less a man like you, my paraphrase, who is abominable and corrupt, and a man who drinks injustice like water. Pretty powerful argument, isn't it? God is so pure that even heaven's not holy, and Eliphaz's way of thinking about it. God even puts no trust in his holiest messenger, so how much less in Job? Now the irony of this is when the evil one showed up in heaven when the sons of God are before God and he said, I've been going to and fro in all the earth. God said, have you considered my servant Job? So wasn't God putting all confidence in his servant Job? And isn't that the opposite of what Eliphaz is suggesting in this passage? Yes. So that's a that's a part of the story that's real important in the enemy's strategy here. All right, now verse 17 and following, Eliphaz said, I want to show you now what I've seen. I want to declare to you what wise men have been told. I want to lay before you the assumption upon which we have always lived life. And that is, now then, he turns to the line of thought in this second round of conversations. What happens to the wicked man? Remember, Job has said so far, when they've been making their claims to him, I have seen some wicked men who've not been through near what I've been through right now. So they've been saying, if a person is righteous, God will do this and this and this for him. And Job has been saying, wait a minute. I have seen some situations where guys have not paid a bit of attention to God, and they hadn't had this kind of pain. They haven't had to deal with this kind of questions in their lives. So now then the discussion turns to the wicked. And what Eliphaz is going to say is, well, the wicked just don't know how soon all of their prosperity and so forth is going to come to an end, which sometimes is true, but it's not always the case. Look at what he says here. The wicked man, verse 20, writhes in pain all his days through all the years that are laid up for the ruthless. That doesn't fit with some of the statements that are made in other passages of Scripture, like in Jeremiah. I've been reading Jeremiah for a class on Wednesday night. Oh, Jeremiah is going to ask here, why do the wicked prosper? So they don't always, people who ignore God, don't always seem to be writhing in pain. Sometimes they seem to be winning. Psalm 73 is built on this. Remember, the writer says, my foot, when I looked around and saw how easy the people who ignore God have it, and how everything they touch seems to turn to gold, my feet had well nigh slipped. Remember that? He said, I went to the house of God and I considered, remember what he said? Their latter end. And the question is whether that latter end means in this life or in eternity. Let's look at it now a little bit, what he has to say. The wicked doesn't believe that he'll walk in darkness, verse 22. All he thinks about is bread for the day and so forth. And then verse 24, distress and anguish terrify and they prevail again. In other words, what Eliphaz is saying is, Job, the wicked may seem to you like they're doing okay, but they really live in fear and turmoil every day of their lives. And then verse 25, the reason is, Because he stretched out his hand and he defies the Almighty, and he runs about stubbornly against God. He covers his face with his fat, his prosperity, verse 27 says. He takes advantages of people. He's just living in a desolate city, which is ready to become a heap of ruin. And verse 29 is the key statement. Travis, read if you would.
He will not be rich, and his wealth will not endure, nor will his possessions spread over the earth.
All right. Now, there is Eliphaz's point, that the wicked man who seems to be doing well is actually that's so temporary that it ought to not even be thought about. And in verse 31 and following, he compares the wicked to a shriveling or dying plant of some sort. And the Bible uses this picture in other contexts to make a powerful point. But here, the wicked man is trusting in emptiness, verse 31, deceiving himself, and emptiness will be his payment. Verse 32 is the problem in his argument. He says, it will be paid in full before his time. He is saying that the wicked man will face the penalty and the loss of his mistake in his time, and it doesn't always happen that way. That's the mistake. All right, it's like a vine dropping its fruit, verse 33. He lives in the company of the barren. Fire consumes his tent. His whole life is just conceiving trouble and giving birth to evil. That's what he says. Now bear in mind, Eliphaz is saying, this is how life works. This is how God rules his world. It unfailingly happens this way. And you and I have to think about it. What does this say then about Job's experience? Therefore, Proposition A, the wicked are headed to ruin. Proposition B, Job, you have been ruined. Therefore, that would be called the major premise, minor premise, and then the conclusion. The conclusion would be, Job, you are wicked, and you should take this as a warning. You should take what has happened to you now as a warning about what you are facing in the land beyond the river, so to speak. Now, all of this is calculated to shape Job's confidence. Eliphaz doesn't necessarily mean it that way, but the enemy means it to shape Job's integrity. And this is reinforcement for the words of Job's wife, which were, remember?
Aye.
All right. Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. And this is trying to put that on. All right, now. That's the introduction to our lesson today. So much for time management. Now look at verse 16, or chapter 16. Then Job answers, and this is, I want you to think about what this says to us. If we're going to live for the Lord, sometimes we're going to have to be willing to hold to Him whether we think we're getting what we want from or need from other people or not. Look at verses 1 through 5 of Job 16. Becky, you got that. Do you mind to read there?
Then Job answered, I have heard many such things.
All right, just stop there for a second. Notice how this ties to verse 17 of chapter 15. I'll show you, hear me, what I've seen, I'll declare. This is what we've heard from our fathers. Job says, yeah, I've heard all those sermons too. Sort of. That's a paraphrase. That's sort of. All right. Go ahead.
Long-winded speeches.
Long-winded speeches. That's right. Listen to this next line in this.
Sorry, comforter.
All right. Read that in the right tone of voice. Now, you did pretty good, Becky. I think Becky's practiced that. Miserable comforters are you all. All right. Well, I wish I could hear as good as Joe Feeney. Maybe I could if I wasn't talking. I think you're listening for it. All right. And let me just read the rest of this little section here. Becky, verse 3 now.
Is there no limit to windy words?
Look at that again. The windy words. All right.
Or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could suppose words against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the salt of my lips could lessen your pain.
All right, think about that. What are you saying?
It's kind of like you say now, with friends like you.
Yeah. Job is saying, I could give smart answers if I were sitting over there watching the ash heap instead of sitting on it. I would know all the answers. But what he says is, though, and this is a more powerful point, if I were in that spot, I would strengthen you with my words. I would try to relieve your pain with what I said if I were in that spot. Of course, that is saying you're not helping me much with what you're saying here. All right, I meant to get to the end of chapter 16. So much for good intentions. Hope you guys have a good week. Come back and see us next time. We'll finish this part of the study.